Welcome to Mental Health Monday. My name is Mick Coyle, coming up on the programme this week.
I was a bit like, I need to do something and I don't know what to do with myself. So I started going swimming just every day. That was my thing and kind of enabled me to start to not make sense of things, but I think just maybe make peace a little bit.
I guess there's part of your body which is almost in survival mode a little bit, saying you're in a very strange place. And I wonder whether that's it's a trick of the body that sort of allows you, once you get into the flow of a swim, to then relax into thoughts, because it's grounded itself on water, for want of a better phrase.
It was definitely just a lot that was unresolved. And, you know, a year is nothing in dealing with something like this. So to then have all of that unresolved and then experience it again, it's too much. It's more than someone can actually handle.
And I'll be reminding you how you can make connections with mental health organisations within your community. It's Mental Health Monday. Welcome to the podcast. Thanks for checking out Mental Health Monday once again. My name is Mick Coyle. It is always a pleasure to have you with us on this programme as we open up the conversation around mental health. Quick mention of the last 2 weeks worth of programming. Thank you to everybody who took part in our Iron Men special, part one and part two. You can still listen back to them, of course, episodes 217 and 218. Our incredible Iron Men who shared their journeys of suicide, their experiences, how they came through. And of course, we met those brilliant services that are now available. There are links to all those services within the wording of the podcast as well. So if you get it from Audio Boom or wherever you catch your podcasts, have a look in the brief, if you like, because you'll find links to all those services. There's an article as well, which contains links to even more services as well. So if that has sparked a conversation in yourself or thoughts within yourself, there are lots of places to turn. As ever, we'll signpost to local services and national services at the end of this podcast. I'm going to continue the conversation around suicide, but it goes off in a slightly different angle actually today with a filmmaker called Kat White. Now, Kat has just wrapped on a film called 54 Days. Now, literally, it stopped filming just about a week ago, and it's into its final stages. Kat's personal experience of suicide of both a family member and a friend have meant that she's gone on her own journey when it comes to grief and dealing with it. Now, part of that is wild swimming, which I don't think is something we've particularly mentioned too many times on the program before, as a way of grounding yourself or finding a new way of finding a safe space to think, if you like. But that's something that Kat has explored in her own personal journey, and it's also something that she's reflected within the new film, 54 Days, starring, among others, Celia Imrie from, she's in everything, Best Exotic Marigold Hotel, loads of different films as well. So it's quite an extraordinary personal journey that she's been on. And of course, the fact she's been able to turn it into a piece of artwork in a short film as well, which is just, you know, incredible in and of itself. It also touches on some of the other aspects as well, and the inequalities that we have both around mental health and also around swimming, which is not something that you would necessarily consider something where there are sort of structural inequalities from people from different ethnic backgrounds. But absolutely, it is the case. And I think when we talk about access to mental health services, we also need to talk about access to all different things in life, which shouldn't be prevented by how much money you earn or what background you come from or where your parents grew up and so on and so forth as well. So there's a lot bundled into this conversation. So I hope you find a fascinating one. I certainly did. She's an absolute joy to spend some time with as well. Kat White on this week's Mental Health Monday.
Thank you for having me, Mick. I love your podcast. I'm really happy to be here with you. It's great.
And I think this is going to be a really eye-opening conversation. You're the creator of a new film. The film just wrapped it literally like a week ago. So it's a real pleasure to sort of be speaking so quickly. Actually, it's called 54 Days. We'll get into what the film is about in terms of the narrative for the film itself, but it comes off the back of your own sort of personal experience. And just in the last week or so, we were talking about suicide stats and the sort of devastating impact that can have. And unfortunately, you've had your experience, haven't you, both within family, within friends groups of suicides, and you've experienced that sort of tragedy firsthand.
Yeah, I have. And I think the particularly difficult thing, just in terms of my own journey, is that so January 2020, right before we kind of went into the first lockdown, actually, I lost my uncle completely unexpectedly, as everyone always says, I'm sure. And, you know, it's always the same way. You just don't see it coming. So that completely just took me by surprise, took me, you know, I don't even still have the words to speak about. And then, of course, off the back of that, we were going straight into lockdown, which meant that nothing was the same. And particularly in the Caribbean community, we've got like quite particular grieving practices, and we would normally be together, especially after a loss like that, for quite a long time, none of which was possible. So I sort of started swimming just as a thing to do. I live really near like a lake with lots of no swimming signs, but I was a bit like, I need to do something and I don't know what to do with myself. So I started going swimming just every day. That was my thing, and kind of enabled me to start to not make sense of things, but I think just maybe make peace a little bit, until, you know, fast forward almost exactly a year later. And I know January as well is always the month, isn't it? It's January the 15th, I think it's been Monday. So for me, January the 4th and then January the 18th, I lost my friend to suicide. And that in particular, I think also because by that point we were, you know, at the end, we were in third lockdown by that point. I was just like, I cannot believe that this is happening and I'm here and again. And I think it was just like the most confusing thing. And what was interesting was with people we'd just been together, you know, Christmas. So that in itself is really complicated. But with my friend, Simon, I was like, I don't even really know when we last saw each other. And actually, interestingly, it was the same sort of time I'd last seen him, Christmas before we locked down. Of course, that was sort of the last time everyone was normal. And we'd spoken, we'd obviously spoken all the time, but I was just like, I don't even know the last proper conversation we had face to face. And it's a bit different with a friend as well. We were all, you know, our group, we were a tight group, and that in itself was really complicated. And we were sort of having these nightly Zooms and trying to do all these things, and everyone was feeling really different, and I just still had this thing of like, I need to do something. So it was swimming again, and I was by that point in, you know, a much, much worse place than I had been before, which is confusing. So I was already in such a bad place. Yeah, not to put too fine a point on it, but swimming saved me. It really saved my life. I went every single morning. I go first thing in the morning, 6, 7 sometimes. And especially in, you know, January, the depths of winter, I was often the only person there, which it's almost like a holy thing. That's the way I describe it. I know my mum will probably hate me saying that. She's a Christian woman, but it felt like my church almost. Like I could feel everything I needed to feel. And that is often, was often absolute sorrow. Like it's the only place I would often cry, but also it's like weirdly a euphoria almost, because I just felt like I understood, and I felt like I was connected to them wherever they would be, and it felt like a place where I could make sense somehow of what happened. And I think another thing, sorry, just because that it kind of leads into the film, but I mean, I've been working with Papyrus, Young Suicide Prevention Charity, on the film before we start speaking about that. But something I found out from them that I didn't know was that actually one of the biggest like at-risk groups for suicide are those who have lost someone to suicide, which I didn't know. And it seems like the most blindingly obvious thing, that why would you do that when you know what it does to everyone there? But of course, actually, it makes you question everything about like the really scary things about why we're here and what's the point. And I think swimming, or like just be grounding myself in something as real and lived as water, somehow without me knowing it at the time, stopped me from going to that place, I think.
Just on from a physical point of view, it's interesting, isn't it? Because of course, and by the way, I've just finished like a project looking at like water safety, so like if people are going to go wild swimming, you know, yes, do follow the signs, you know, try and swim within a group and so on and so forth. I'll make that point. But just in terms of what you're saying there, do you think there was something in that moment that it was, you were in the water, it was cold, there almost, And people talk about being mindful, don't they? You know, if you mindfully walk, where you don't think about anything else, you don't go on your phone, you just walk, you think about the steps, you think about the breathing. And I guess when you're wild swimming, and I've not done it myself, you almost don't have the ability to think about other things, because I guess there's parts of your body which is almost in survival mode a little bit, saying you're in a very strange place in the middle of the night almost. Yeah. And you're on. And I wonder whether that's it's a trick of the body that sort of allows you, once you get into the flow of a swim, to then relax into thoughts, because it's grounded itself on water, for want of a better phrase.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. I mean, there is literally a scientific explanation, isn't there? There's the dopamine firstly, but then there is also, yeah, it's exactly that. Your body is like responding to the very physical state, the conditions that you've put it in, and it can't focus on anything else. And what that does, I guess, is clears your, and whatever you're holding. So I don't know about you, I often found that it would be like a feeling in my chest rather than a thought, or, you know, it's quite bodily, I think, grief often. So I think the water also somehow, like, I don't know, I don't have the answers. I'm sure a scientist might be able to write in and tell us, but I think you're absolutely right that that's a huge part of it.
Well, I think it's great that you were able to find something. I think there will be a lot of people who are thinking, what's my swimming? What's my thing that allows me that sort of moment or sense of the euphoria or the personal reflection? I think often, and we've touched on this many, many times in the program, the sense of grief from suicide is completely different to other aspects of grief that people maybe are more used to, or that we've almost developed sort of like coping mechanisms for. And it was interesting you said at the start you were dealing with the family grief, but then to be compounding with a friend. And I guess if you hadn't answered the questions, or you still had questions about, you know, the first death that you experienced, presumably they trebled and were 10 times more difficult to answer second time around.
Yeah, exactly. And I think I'd dabble with trying to kind of, you know, have therapy first time, and hadn't really, I think I wasn't ready, actually. I was really quickly like, I'm not okay, let me go and speak to someone, this is what we do. And I didn't, it just didn't work out. And then things were going just really weird anyway, because of course we were then locking down and everything suddenly stopped, and people hadn't quite figured out Zoom at that stage. So that didn't work in that moment. So it was definitely just a lot that was unresolved. And, you know, a year is nothing in dealing with something like this. So to then have all of that unresolved and then experience it again, it's too much. It's more than someone can actually handle, obviously, I think.
At what point did you start thinking there is a creative outlet to this journey that I'm going on? You know, that there's an opportunity to sort of use my skill set to contextualize it within a slightly different framework and to create the film. At what point did you start having those thoughts? Was it while you were swimming?
Yeah, it was. So firstly, it didn't start off in any way as me being like, this is going to be a film. I was just like sort of doing this every day, and I was like, I've been doing this for quite a long time now, like, do I do it forever? And, you know, at the water, you meet really amazing people. So particularly as we were moving into spring, there's like a whole group of people called the Oxford Blue Tits who swim in a lake. It's a really great name. And, you know, you have these conversations with people and you sort of get to know them a bit. You know, you see each other every day or a few times a week. So I was kind of like, found that really comforting in itself. Like, okay, I'll go here and I will see X next person. So that was already kind of in my mind, as like, there's something really, really special about this. And then it was as I was sort of starting to feel better, I suppose, which I also often have kind of found it uncomfortable to admit, because you feel like, how can you ever feel better? But I was starting to feel better. And I was like, there's something really healing about what I'm doing. And it took me, you know, it's a year and a half of swimming before I got to that point. But I was like, this is really helping me. I want to talk about this with more people, especially being a Black woman. And we don't really swim. Like, there aren't enough of us. We've like just had the very first Black woman ever to represent GB, Alice Deering, amazing, amazing woman. But there is no precedent for like being a Black woman or any other group that doesn't traditionally get into the water And using that, exactly as you say, there are probably loads of people who are wishing they had their swimming. And I was sort of also thinking, like, you could have your swimming if you wanted. And I kind of want you to know that. So it's, and then, yeah, so that's all, you know, me swimming each day and kind of thinking these things, going home at night, ruminating on them a bit more. And then one night, honestly, I'm not joking. It always sounds, people always say this, but I honestly just like sat up in bed and I was like, this is an amazing idea for a film. And I like got out of bed and I was like on my laptop, I was just like writing all these notes. And I like planned, honestly, the like journey of the film overnight. I didn't write it overnight, but I wrote the first draft really, really quickly, probably like the 2 or 3 days later that week. Then obviously refined it and worked on it for a few, well, for ages. I'm a perfectionist, so I worked on it for ages, but it hasn't changed much from my initial idea, which was that it's simple. It's about a girl who decides to start swimming every day after she loses someone she loves to suicide. And it's really simple. And that is kind of like the point of it. She meets a friend, you know, someone really unexpected, and played by the amazing Celia Imrie, by the way, who you probably know from, you know, everything. She meets this woman at the water's edge and they kind of were very suspicious of each other at first, but then they build a friendship. And we kind of move in and out of Ruby, the main character's home life, and how her family are grieving. Her brother is grieving in a really different way to her. He doesn't want to do anything, and Ruby just wants to get out there and swim and do and honor her dad and do these things. And I think that I also really wanted to explore, because I was like, there is no right or wrong way to grieve. And so many of my friends were just like, I was wanting, what can we do? Let's plan for when COVID's over. We can do a big memorial and honor something. And lots of people just didn't want to and couldn't. And I kind of wanted to reflect that too, that journey of just like, however you choose to grieve or to deal with whatever it is that you're going through, that is okay if that's what suits you in that moment and that's what you need to do to survive. So I guess that's a really long-winded way of me saying that it's actually a really hopeful story, because it's about how we heal. And yeah, it's the story I wanted. I wish I'd kind of seen this film a year ago, or, you know, read about it, because yeah, we don't speak enough about what happens after. And of course it's important that we have that we heal from it. And that's how I guess we will eventually have these conversations and change things, I hope.
I think as much as anything, that was very powerful, by the way. So thank you for being so honest. I think the idea of grief as a process, as opposed to this sort of capital G grief thing, where it's like somebody died, so there's grief, but then there's a funeral and now we all move on. I think it's so interesting to say that actually that process has no time frame to it. And actually, from what you've described there, we should also consider is actually having no restrictions to it. So if that means part of your grief experience involves a new hobby or a new activity or the wild swimming or hanging around with Celia Imrie or, you know, her real life equivalents and the Oxford blue tits and finding a new group of friends, then I think you almost have to just accept, don't you, that that process is going on and that it came from a place which was the moment, but now it's taking you in this direction. And I don't think at any point you would suddenly think, well, oh, this no longer has anything to do with the grief, or this is, but it's just life. I don't know, just life seems to happen, and it involves these people, and it involves sometimes a sense of community, and it involves sometimes doing things a little bit differently. Mm-hmm. And I guess when we get to the end of our lives are only ever, you know, the adding up of all of those different things, yeah, and the people that we met and how they change maybe our perceptions and thoughts on different, yeah, things, in the hope that, you know, as we get older, when similar situations come or people come to us experiencing those situations, we can offer an empathy, which isn't just have you tried doing this? It's actually, I know exactly how you feel. This is what worked for me. Let's find your version,
yes,
of the wild,
yes,
swimming.
Yes.
Let's find your version of whatever it might be. I think when we're in that position where empathy is absolutely king or queen, then I think we can all feel like we're in a much better place. Because at the moment we have essentially a set of rules, which is you're feeling bad. Of course you're feeling bad. 150 years ago, you know, women would wear black if their husbands died, yeah, because that's how you grieve.
Yeah.
But that's I don't want to say that's a nonsense, that might have worked for some people, but that's very structured, isn't it? And like, these are the rules. And it happens to, you know, it's recent experiences where, you know, family members, lost family members, maybe in a whole host of different ways. And things like parents who keep the curtains closed for a number of days and so on and so forth, almost like the rules of grief with a capital G. And I think as soon as we start to see that actually that might not be appropriate, or that there might be other ways,
yeah,
I think grief becomes a lot less of a scary word and actually becomes a much more of a journey.
Right.
If that makes sense.
Yeah, that absolutely makes sense. And I think also that is, in a weird way, something that we have, not to thank COVID for, but that is something that we have been able to experience because of what we've gone through, and because we have not been able to do all of these traditional things, we've had to look for other avenues. And I really actually hope that we will take that with us after this, when we can kind of have the normal rituals again, because you're right, it's a journey. And it isn't that we have these two or three, you know, the funeral and the da 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 and the da da da, and that's it. It's more that we will probably, well, we will carry it for the rest of our lives. What can we pick up along the way? What can we share? What can we pass on? What can we also leave behind us for other people who are then beginning to navigate this? It will never be over. We will carry it forever. And I think seeing it as a journey is also really reassuring, because it lets you know that if you're feeling any sort of way, yeah, it's okay. It is okay. I really, really like that. I think it's really wise.
Can I ask you about, and I've had experience of this when people have had experience when they have a physical response to grief. So they've been taking up running would be a good one, joining football organisations. And occasionally people will tell me about they pick up a calf injury, or, you know, they break their foot or something like that. And they suddenly can't do the thing. They can't get physically into that space as well. And I just wondered if you'd had that experience yet, you know, if there were times where you hadn't been swimming for a number of days, or you were called away for a meeting and suddenly you hadn't had that thing for a period of time. And how did it feel? And were you just thinking, I need to get near some water quickly? Or were you, you know, just urging yourself to dive in anywhere?
Yeah, because I mean, that is also quite scary, right? You don't want to need the thing that is keeping you afloat, not to use too much of a swimming pun. But interestingly, I always thought my thing would be running. Like, I'm a runner. It always was running before, but I couldn't face running, because running reminded me of life before. And it felt like life before didn't exist anymore. It had to be something different, which eventually translated into swimming, just because I would be walking past this lake. I was like, do you know what, I'm gonna go in. That's how it started. But yeah, eventually I was, you know, often you have days where you don't swim for whatever reason, or don't want to swim for whatever reason, and I would sometimes make myself feel a bit guilty about that, which I think also isn't helpful. So that in itself was a journey. And it was, you know, if I swim, it's because I want to, and I have that conversation with myself. It's like, do you actually want to get up soon? Especially now, like, I'm not really swimming every day at all. I swim probably once a week now, normally at a weekend, because life has resumed and it doesn't work anymore. I don't need it in that way, but it does feel amazing to know that if I do need to just take myself to a place that will make me feel what I need to feel, that it's there. It's like almost a sort of safety blanket type thing.
And I'm so pleased that you're able to find it. And I think this is one of those other things that sometimes people will go, oh, well, I listened to Kat talking about that, and I tried as well, but it didn't work for me. And then if you then put a pause on that and go, well, so I can't move on with my grief, but actually it might be like the 10th thing that you try might be your thing. And I think there's an element of resilience, I think, within everybody to think, well, that didn't work, fine. Let's give it another go. Okay, maybe it doesn't quite work for me. Let's try something else. And we all need to find that, because the thing you found, you're almost talking about it as if it's almost like a religious ceremony.
Yeah, yeah.
Like. I think if people could sort of find their version of that, I think people would be, I think people would find themselves in a better place sooner. Within a sense that of community, so they're not instantly thinking, right, I need to scattergun my way through life to try and find some way of moving forward. The arms come round shoulders and say, okay, let's give this a go, let's try this, let's move forward together. Let's move on with the conversation, Kat, because I know there's plenty of topics. You touched on it before, and actually, you know, the inequalities we have within this country, I know you certainly are aware of them, given your own personal experience, but also from a wild swimming point of view. There's this incredible stat that, you know, it's almost 9 out of 10 black adults don't swim. I think it's 8 out of 10 black children don't swim. At the same time, when we talk about mental health, only now are we going to start seeing ethnic breakdowns of suicide figures. I think it's the Mental Health Foundation talk of people from certain black backgrounds being more prone to certain mental health problems throughout their lives as well. So a lot of the topics that you touch on within your life experiences, but also the film, have this bubbling under inequality that actually exists within the UK. And it would be great if we could at least all start on dealing with grief from a position of parity.
Yeah.
But actually, that's not the case. And we've got to be mindful of that as well, haven't we?
Yeah, absolutely. And that is something that I think about all the time, because it's only by chance that I live near a lake. Like, how many people live near a lake they can just go and swim in? Most people don't. And I think that in itself is something that I'm sometimes a bit hesitant to speak too much about, like, this saved me and it's amazing, because, like, that was a privilege that I happened to be able to do that. I've been working with Soulcap. I don't know if you've heard of them.
No, only just in reading up on your story. Just explain for us what they are.
Yeah, they're an amazing, inclusive, so you can see my hair, like, this doesn't fit into a normal swimming cap. So my mum got me a Soulcap for Christmas, this last Christmas. And so they're an inclusive swimwear brand who are just kind of trying to improve accessibility to the water, not just for, you know, black people, but also for people who don't have the financial resources to be able to swim. Like, swimming is now really, really expensive, and that's a really tricky thing, that if you're from a lower income background, you probably won't learn how to swim because you can't actually afford it. And that not only has huge repercussions on people's mental health, but also is a real physical, and you said you're doing lots of work on this summer, it's a real physical thing that people need to be able to know how to swim. So I think that is something that I've learned a lot. I've had my eyes opened, and Soulcap, I really encourage everyone to check out what they're doing. They're doing such amazing work in that area. And I think I also then started to make the connection that, okay, so I was able to swim. Swimming saved me. That's so amazing. Then I became mental health first aid trained. Then I started to do my research, and I was like, okay, so black people are more likely to be diagnosed than any other ethnicity with a severe mental health problem. Then I went even further, and I was like, they're also more likely to encounter inpatient health problems. So not only are they more likely to be diagnosed, but they're also more likely to be misdiagnosed or to encounter problems with the way they're treated. So there's like an overrepresentation that is really, really scary in the way that we see it in the prison population, for example. And there's really not enough research that's been done into that. And I just started to make the connection between accessibility to things like the water that could be really healing and helpful, and the fact that most black people don't have access to that. So, I mean, I don't know what I'm saying. What's the answer? I think representation. I think even if, you know, me speaking on this and someone listens to it and is like, do you know what? Yeah, I will go and try swimming. And of course, I've mentioned Alice Deering. We've now seen some at the Olympics. So I think representation is really important. But there's also a lot more that, like, organisations like Soulcap on the ground are doing that is so important to improve accessibility. I mean, everyone should have access to a body of water, right? It's just the most natural thing that exists.
But it's that thing, isn't it, where that's why for years and years people have dismissed equality issues around women or men or people from different backgrounds, whoever it is, because there's a presumption that because there's now a law that's about discrimination, that issue has been solved, and it's now just stats. And sometimes the stats go one way and sometimes the stats go another way. Except in reality, the stats don't go anywhere. If anything, the stats just compound year in, year out. And then things happen in life. Life experiences happen. And it's happened with COVID, and it's happened with people from poor backgrounds. It's about to happen now with people who are on universal credit, whereby suddenly political choices, which should be much more, I guess, holistic in their approach, instead focus on numbers and spreadsheets.
Yeah,
and maybe I'm making a political point I shouldn't be making, but it's a sense where if everyone was starting from an equal point, those political decisions would be almost harder to make, because you couldn't then just rely on traditional inequalities or the way we'd always done something. Yeah. I think politicians would have to work harder to find the group that they could ignore or pick on, because you go, oh, no, everyone's the same now, so we can't really do that. But it's quite clear, no matter what we talk about politically in the UK, there's always a group of people who find themselves at the wrong end of it. And it's not the first time they've found themselves on the wrong end of a decision. And it won't be the last. And unfortunately, in many cases, they know it. And and I think in a lot of cases, and I was talking about this with an MP, it's come to be expected that experience will, because that's the way it always is.
Yeah,
that is
not surprised.
That's the settlement that we've reached, I think was the phrase that I heard one MP use. It was the same around, you know, the safety of women and the murder of Sarah Everard, threw up all these emotions based on women's experiences of harassment, assault, violence, and so on and so forth. But again, because of that inequality over such a long period of time, it was almost presumed that we just sort of learned to live with that as an issue. And actually, that it was so interesting to see that Sarah Everard, horrendous tragedy, actually then inspired women to say, actually, this deal that we've got going on isn't working.
Yeah, why are we scared to walk home at night? And like, having never reflected on that before, like, that just is how it is. Like, you don't walk home alone.
You don't walk home alone because it's dark and you might get attacked. Oh, right. So for the rest of our lives, we will teach our children that they might get attacked. And you've got to be aware of dangers that are around you. But this like institutionalized thing that, and if you do get attacked, well, maybe you should have, you know, got a taxi, that's sort of the victim blaming that sometimes comes in those situations. We are getting quite political on the program, aren't we?
Right. I know, sorry. I think it is that. It's like realizing that like men don't feel that. Men aren't afraid to walk home alone at night. And I think it's the same thing. It was me suddenly being like, oh, wait a minute, like lots of other people swim, but no one who looks like me does. It's like you just assume things are normal, and it takes a certain experience, Sarah Everard, or me being like, I've lost two people and there's no one who looks like me doing this, to really make you reflect and realize that it doesn't have to be that way. I think you've touched on something really, really important there.
And the film's called 54 Days. Just tell us about, you literally wrapped just the other day. So just tell us what process you've got sort of going now before it might end up on a screen where we can see it.
Yeah, so we've just wrapped, literally last week, and we are trying to kind of scrabble together all the rest of, so to break it down, we kind of shot it quite quickly because it's about to get really cold and we have a lot of swimming and we couldn't really leave it much longer. So we'd raised enough money, you know, crowdfunded and got support from amazing places. So we shot it with what we had, and we're trying to sort of raise the rest of it to finish the film. And hopefully it'll be ready by early next year. And we really want to, you know, do big things, start big conversations with it. We want to have a big gala screening where we can get leading figures from the mental health world, from the swimming world, and really kind of have these important conversations as well about, you know, grief and suicide and swimming and inaccessibility to water. So that is where we're at. And it is such an amazing, amazing film. I'm biased, I know, but I think I was actually blown away by what I saw and the response that we're getting so far. And even just being on that set and so many people replying and saying that they had also experienced suicide. And I think the more you talk about it, the more you understand that lots of people have lost someone to suicide. And that in itself really blew me away, because until it happened to me, I don't think I knew anyone. And now on that film alone, three people plus me, plus other people who perhaps didn't want to speak about it, have lost someone very, very close to them to suicide, which is just astonishing if you think about it. So
you actually had sort of a mental health first aider on set, in an official capacity as well, which I think, you know, when we talk about, you know, the standards that we should expect moving forward within work environments, I think that really sets a standard. It obviously comes from a place from your own sort of personal experience as well, but actually you were obviously aware that these conversations would be taking place and these issues would be brought up, and maybe some of your own experiences brought up too. To have that as a resource, what was that like?
It was, I'm honestly, Mick, I'm so proud that we did that. The fact that it's not normal is just unbelievable how can we be filming something like this and not have that there? So we worked with incredible Laura White, and she was just on standby, and anything that someone needed, she could then go and have a conversation with them. She could do some breathing exercises. She could talk them out of wherever they'd had to go. So obviously for the actors, it seems a no-brainer, but also for the crew, as I've now, you know, mentioned, we actually found out that we had a number of our crew who have lived through losing a father to suicide, for example. It was so important that Laura was there as a focal point and they could check in with her. She followed up with them. She's provided resources. It was just, you know, I'm so proud that we did it. And I think we're the first production that have done this, which is quite extraordinary.
But what about that, you know, for somebody who takes on a job doing sound or light, and because it's the next job that's come along, yeah, suddenly they're on a set where suddenly these issues are being talked about in maybe a way that they've not heard them talked about before.
Yeah.
To then have somewhere to turn to.
Yeah.
What a great resource to have. In the same way that if somebody falls off a ladder and breaks their arm, the first aid is on the set, yeah, you know, with the physical. But actually, to have it from a mental first aid point of view, it's just like this extra area of padding around the set, you know, to keep people safe.
And I've committed, and I'll say it publicly, I will never make another film without a mental health coordinator on set. And I'll say it right here, right now, it is essential. And I really hope other filmmakers follow suit. I think it's so important to set that precedent.
Absolutely, absolutely. People can support 54 Days as well. I know you've sort of got your final sort of production sort of elements to add to. You mentioned the crowdfunding before. How can people support the movie to get it over the line?
Yeah, so on our website, 54days.com, we've got a donor box. So any support would be so welcome. We're also on Instagram, 54 Days Film. Get that right. And we're sharing all of our news and bits and bobs there. So please do follow and join the journey.
Absolutely. Kat, it's an absolute pleasure to get you on the program today. Thank you so much for being so honest about your own experience as well. And I think people will be really keen to sort of see how that all sort of passes itself onto the big screen as well. We'll put links as well to the sites you just mentioned in the write-up to the podcast, and fingers crossed people can support you to get over the line. Look forward to seeing the movie 54 Days. Kat White, thank you for your time.
Thank you so much, Mick. Take care.
I hope you've enjoyed this week's podcast. Thanks for checking out Mental Health Monday. My name is Mick Coyle. You can find me on Twitter at Mr. Mick Coyle. You can also find me, Mick Coyle, on Facebook as well. Don't forget, if you want to speak to somebody about your mental health, you can do so. The Samaritans, free to call on 116 123. You can find mental health services where you are. Just look for the Hub of Hope. Type in your postcode. It'll find those mental health services close to you. And for support in a crisis, you can text SHOUT to 85258. That's if you're experiencing a personal crisis, you're unable to cope and need support. Shout to 85258. That's a text line. Do get involved in those services. In an absolute emergency, always remember the number to call is 999. Thanks for downloading the podcast this week. We'll be back next week with more Mental Health Monday.